As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
You're listening to the Game Podcast from The Times. Today we react to the two big games involving Premier League clubs in the Champions League quarterfinals. It's victory for Manchester City and a very comfortable one over Bayern Munich, but Chelsea are beaten by Real Madrid. Is that their involvement over? We'll discuss Dean Smith's appointment as Leicester City's interim boss until the end of the season. Will that give them a greater chance of staying up? And we'll celebrate Wrexham's victory over Notts County through gritted teeth in the National League. This is The Game. Hello and welcome back to The Game Podcast. I am Hugh Wizencroft alongside Tom Clark, Tony Cascarino in London, and joining us from Ghent, Gregor Robertson. I don't know why I said it so aggressively, but they are playing West Ham, so maybe it's that. Gentlemen, hello. Lots for us to discuss, obviously, because Gregor is out in Ghent for a Europa Conference League match. You know that it is European week and the Champions League has taken centre stage for the last couple of nights. We'll talk about last night's game first of all, which was a defeat for an English side in the Champions League quarterfinal first leg. Chelsea going to have it all to do, I think, if they're to reach the final four after they lost to Real Madrid, the holders, at the Bernabeu. Karim Benzema with a tap-in, that was his 90th goal in the competition. And Real Madrid struggled to add to that lead. Neither side played particularly well until Ben Chilwell was shown a straight red card on the 59th minute for fouling Rodrigo, with the Brazil forward through on goal. Marco Asensio got a second for Real Madrid to make it seem a little bit more comfortable and make the Spanish side, I think, firm favourites to go through, despite the fact Chelsea have a home match to come. Of course, Tony, it's your former club, but really on the evening, it was kind of an underwhelming game in that some of the predictions never came true at all, really. Some were thinking Real Madrid would absolutely skittle Chelsea. That never happened. They never played to their best, though. We didn't see a resurgent Chelsea. We didn't see an embarrassing Chelsea either. It wasn't really a damp squib, but failed to deliver fireworks, let's say that.
Yeah, it was a strange game to watch in many ways, because Chelsea kept giving the ball away, and certainly in midfield areas, and they've got huge experience with internationals. Obviously, Fernandes, N'Golo Kante, Kovacic, you know, all top quality internationals who play for some of the biggest nations in world football. They lacked so much up front. It was scary, you know, watching Sterling and Felix trying to make headway, and Okad had an opportunity early on. Look, they've gone now, what, four games before this, that game last night about scoring. You can clearly see that they don't look... I mean, I did laugh because after the match, Frank Lampard's first quote was, "We've got, you know, the opportunity now to make it a very special night at Stamford Bridge." Now, what evidence can you give Chelsea any chance? Real Madrid didn't have to play their best football last night. Now, they were... Mm. I mean, I thought for Vinicius Junior, he had Fofana in his pocket, and also Reece James, he went up against either of them and he embarrassed them a couple of times. He was absolutely on fire. Benzema led the line like only Benzema can. He was brilliant in his role as that centre forward. Rodrigo on the other side was causing problems. Chelsea looked unfit as well, Hugh. That didn't look a fit Chelsea team. I know, obviously, Kante's been out injured. Thiago Silva has. Koulibaly's been injured at times. Reece James has been injured at times. That showed. They looked like they weren't able, Reece James is another one, able to match physically. I felt Real Madrid were comfortable. Look, it's 2-0. We don't need any more.
Without playing particularly well,
which Real Madrid are not quite as good as what they were last season. Mm. You know, there is evidence that, you know, you look at them and think they're not quite the same team.
I think that was their fifth win in the past 10 matches. I mean, it's not like they're battering everyone at the moment. No, despite some big wins over Barcelona,
well, yeah,
of course.
Barcelona game stands out. I'm very pessimistic about Chelsea's chances because I don't see any evidence to say, you know, first of all, Real Madrid are a great counter-attack team. So if Chelsea press and press, Vinicius Jr. doesn't chase back. He doesn't chase back the forwards or the wing-backs. He tends to let them go, and if they get the ball, they're straight to him. And he does that brilliantly well. It used to be the cheating sort of role. People say he's cheating, he's not getting back and tracking back. But it's quite clear, Ancelotti's saying, stay there, and if we do rob the ball, because we have enough legs elsewhere, and when we do get it, it's coming straight to you.
Yeah, I don't think Chelsea were particularly great, Tom, in this game. I don't think Real Madrid were either, but I don't see, I was going to say Graham Potter's side, I don't see Frank Lampard's side summoning anything in the second leg that makes me believe they can go through without, you know, at this point, something miraculous, because I think Real Madrid will score in that game.
It's a strange one. Sat here reflecting on it the morning after, I agree with everything Tony's saying, I agree with your points, Hugh, but it was interesting watching the game during it in the office last night. I was editing last night, and I kind of found myself and a lot of other people in the office quite surprised. And I couldn't decide whether it was whether Madrid were in first gear and weren't that good, or that Chelsea actually at least had a plan. And, you know, Tony, you referenced those three midfielders. When they're fit and on form, that could be a midfield trio to rival any in Europe, really, when you think about that kind of it, both experience and potential of Enzo Fernandez. They could be a real, like, dare I say it, Champions League winning midfield trio. They've got that quality. But then the kind of points about fitness, fatigue, form. I mean, we were speaking to Tom Roddy after the game, who's out there for us, and he was saying he reckons N'Golo Kante's only about 30% fit. But Lampard obviously and understandably went for experience and threw them all in and kind of hoped that it might come off. And I kind of ended up viewing it and sat here listening to you guys thinking about Chelsea in a bigger picture. And Hugh, you know, you referenced it being Graham Potter's side and, oh, no, it's Frank Lampard's side. In reality, it's neither of their sides, is it? Because it's about who the next manager is and brings it forward. And I think what last night showed is that there is, if you get that team, that 11, fit and in form, with a striker, as Tony's saying, then you've got a really, really good team, I think. And it's kind of big picture, blue sky thinking type stuff, when obviously we're saying this was their season, this tie is their season. If they're out, then that's the end of a terrible season. Of course, that's true. But I found myself, and this is easy for me because I'm not a Chelsea fan, but I found myself thinking, actually, there are little seeds there of hope and positivity, despite it being a pretty lacklustre performance and ultimately being beaten by a team packed with experience, who were in first gear, probably.
I'm not too sure about that, or if I am going to agree with you, I think it, for me, points towards the question as to why you got rid of Graham Potter with this tie coming up, really, because in terms of those seeds of positivity, although the results weren't going great for Graham Potter, he didn't have all of the players back that played last night, particularly some of the ones with big experience. He didn't have N'Golo Kante, obviously, that's a big one, but there were some green shoots in some of those games where they didn't get results. So, you know, if that's the positivity to carry forward, you're almost thinking, well, we didn't need Frank Lampard to see that. We'd already seen it under Graham Potter. We already felt, and we've covered it already on the podcast, that you're probably going to get rid of Graham Potter at the end of the season. But for me, it was one of those where I felt you needed to give him until the end of the season and not that many games to see if he might get something out of this squad. Or you sack the manager and you get in one of the plethora of high-quality available coaches and you get them to take you into the tie with Real Madrid. Why you would get Frank Lampard to do it, for me, it made that decision kind of pointless.
But I think, I take your point, but I think some of the things Tom Roddy talked about when we were talking about that change in manager and the, giving them the time almost to get the decision right, and also maybe having a proper assessment of the squad. You know, I was talking to Martin Samuel last night about writing a piece, and he's doing a piece which, by the time you're listening, you can read online, and he decided to write about Carlo Ancelotti instead because he was kind of talking about Chelsea and what they need. And he felt that they really need someone to really get a hold of them and really grip them and shake them up a bit and rile them up and really lift them in that sense. And when you think about the Julian Nagelsmanns of this world, are they that type of character? But then Martin admitted, you then go to who? Antonio Conte, Jose Mourinho, but they're not the type of manager. So that's where I think the Chelsea board are at. They're at this point now where they went for the young tactician, Graham Potter. That didn't work. They bought all these players and they're now torn between, do we go Nagelsmann now, or do we go big character, big guy, 2 years, shake them up, scare the life out of them, lift them?
But even that suggests to me they don't know what they're doing, because the problem at Chelsea was not the coach, really. It's the fact that the club currently is a mess. The squad, through the strategy of recruitment, has become a mess, has become far too many players to realistically coach and develop. You've got to try and rotate, especially when the team's out of form. Then you're looking to the pool of players and thinking, who's going to get me a result here? And you start chopping and changing. There's no consistency. And on top of it all, with respect, you know, a lot of these players, the young ones that they brought in, have not been there and done it, particularly at the highest level. It's not like you spent £600 million on proven quality. You've brought in kids, high potential kids, yes, but you're not going to go out and start blitzing the Premier League and the Champions League by buying Badiashil and Mudryk, you know, and Enzo Fernandez. Well, yeah, highly rated, you know, I get it, high potential players, but you're not talking about people that have been there, won it, got the T-shirt.
It's difficult because there's been a lot of money spent on players that, like Fafanya, and he's been injured, but they still spent a lot of money on him. Cucurella, you know, spent a lot of money on him. Does he look like a natural first teamer at Chelsea? Mm-mm. Not at all. So that's difficult. They've got massive decisions to make, but I totally agree with Tom. There is a core of players that are good enough for Chelsea to make something happen. I think there's lots of different ideas to think about that club, but there is one thing for sure: you're not going to be short of very good footballers. Whether some are ready or some are not, I think you have to find that talent balance. Talent there. Yeah. Sorry, Gregor, you go.
After spending 600 million quid, you would hope that would be the case, though, surely, Tony.
I think there's
far too much, like, people trying to justify what has gone on at Chelsea in the past 8 months or whatever. Like, you're saying this is not Graham Potter's team. No, clearly not. It's not Frank Lampard's team. It's not his fault, like, that this team looks disjointed. It's the next man's team. It's Todd Bowley's team. It's the guy who's living in a fantasy land who was filmed saying, we're going to win 3-0 and the future's bright before the game. Like, that's who's responsible for what this Chelsea team looks like just now.
Yeah.
That's not the fault of any manager or coach. And we could go around the houses with that. I think, and I said beforehand, if you were going to sack Graham Potter, it had to be a major upgrade, and replacing him with Frank Lampard was ludicrous. So the idea of getting a big uplift from Frank Lampard, I think we're already seeing that it's not going to happen.
Just on the subject of that experience point, Tony, you've made and the money spent, I did think it was interesting, and I wanted to ask both you and Tony, Gregor, about the moment when Koulibaly got injured, because it was a kind of 5 minutes of where they're 1-0, they'd had a few counter-attacks, they're kind of in the game. And as I say, in the office, you know, we were chatting about it and going, they could nick a point here, not nick a point, get an equaliser here. And you think about those players, and again, he's gone for Koulibaly. Why? Because he's played in the Champions League. He's played against Real Madrid almost certainly in his career. He's not gone for Cucurella. And there were two things that I thought were interesting. One, you had a player coming onto the pitch where you immediately thought, oh God, this isn't going to go well, just purely because of the experience. Mm. But also, Tony, I found it interesting coming back to your point about fitness and sharpness. And it's always interested me as a fan sometimes when you're watching the game, because sometimes both as a pundit and a fan, you want substitutions, you want to see different players. And sometimes a manager's reluctance to change is actually because to get that game sharpness, to get in there. And that was where the problem came, wasn't it? Where Cucurella came in, and he goes for that challenge, and then he doesn't turn quite as quickly enough, and Rodrigo spins him. And Rodrigo's match sharp. He's been playing for 60 minutes at this point, and he gets in behind him. I wanted to ask, like, how difficult is it in those moments in any game to come on and hit that? Like, should we be criticising Cucurella for that? Or is it just bad luck that the experienced guy gets injured?
Well, there's a couple of things. If you take the first goal and you take the sending off incident, both times a player on the ball for Madrid isn't pressurised.
Yeah.
Okay, so the moment that happens, then he gets his head up and he can find the pass, or he sets Rodrigo away and Chilwell gets sent off. They're things that, why have your players not been able to get to the opposition's midfield quick enough to stop them? It's a Liverpool problem. That's where Liverpool suffered all year. They can't stop teams in midfield getting on the ball and finding passes. Mm. Once you eliminate players, you're dead as a team. Now, on the physical side, which I think is really important, I played my best football when I was at my fittest and my worst football when I was at my unfittest. Mm. Okay? They come hand in hand for me. And me and Q had a conversation in off air about Lukaku and what we would do with it and what would we do with him, because obviously he's a Chelsea player next year. I said straight away, I'd get him back and make him the fittest I could in the pre-season to see if you could get something out of him. Because big centre-forwards, they look lazy, ungamely, awkward, all these things when they're not at their fittest. And I think Chelsea's team last night had at least four players that weren't on their peak condition. And over 90 minutes, you paid for it. And they'll pay for it in the second leg as well.
On the Cucurella, you know, look, it's going to be hard coming into a game at the Bernabeu. Not that I know about that myself, unfortunately. But like, it's always hard adjusting to a game. But in my experience, if you come into a game, you err on the side of caution. Mm. And what he did was the opposite. He stepped out and his body shape was all wrong, when the safe thing to do is to maintain shape, defensive shape. Give yourself a few yards if he does turn, and you can keep pace with them, and Cucurella didn't do that. So I don't think you could put that down to fitness issues. That was a lapse of concentration, and as we've spoken about, just the disjointed nature of this team. There's been so many chops and changes of personnel, team shape. Although they've started to settle on a three-man defence because Chilwell and James are back, it's still a lot of chops and changes. I mean, we mentioned Badi Ashile. I don't think he's even in the Champions League squad, is he?
No, he's not.
So like, they could have done with him. And
could have done with Aubameyang too, to be perfectly honest.
I just want to ask you a question. It's probably all for all three of us, really. Could you still point the finger at Graham Potter because of how he used so many players in so many games, that you created this scenario where so many players have, you know, take Raheem Sterling. You know, he was injured and he was in and out of the team, but he looks like he's the unfittest he's been to me for two or three years. If you look at him as an individual, and I think you can go through a few players at that team and you can point the finger at Graham Potter for this, because you use too many players too often in games and changing your team around.
There were certainly occasions when you looked at the team sheet, of Chelsea's team sheet, and thought, I'm not sure what he's thinking here. But you do have to acknowledge that there were a hell of a lot of injuries too during his time at the club. So some of those changes were enforced. But towards the end of his time, clearly, you would have liked him to have kind of got somewhere closer to a settled team. And it didn't seem to look really like there was much joined up thinking going on.
Gregor, what was Ben Chilwell thinking?
Panic. There is an argument to say when Cucurella steps up, he's got to kind of come round a little bit more and, you know, narrow off the space. But it happens very quickly. And I would say that there weren't really any other threats in the immediate area. Chilwell had a man outside him as well. I personally think it was Cucurella's mistake in the first place, and Chilwell's desperately trying to rectify it. And he'll wish he could take the moment back. That's all you can say. It was a red card and he had to go.
Naive.
Maybe, but I also think...
Gregor's sitting there like, I would have pulled him back as well.
Well, absolutely, yeah. You try and get something. You try and get a little bit of contact on him that's not enough to send them down. And look, depends who you're playing against sometimes too. The player will go down or not. And Rodrigo took the spin and fell to the floor. He's off.
Yeah, well, the funny thing was that I think the Koulibaly injury came from almost exactly the same incident. And Koulibaly's kind of running with Rodrigo and he pulls his arm. And I remember watching it thinking, it's amazing that doesn't get pinged as a foul. And then it literally happened. But obviously, because Chilwell was behind him and not in a 50-50 race, you know, you've got no chance. And then the player's feeling the contact and going down.
Chelsea failed to score, as you mentioned, Tony, four games in a row. First time since 1993, I think, that has happened. And yet Frank Lampard believes they can turn it round at Stamford Bridge. Is the tie over in your eyes?
I think there's more chance of City getting knocked out by Bayern than Chelsea getting through. Honestly? Now, City are 3-0 up and cruise and were brilliant. And of course, I don't think they're going to get knocked out because they're a much better team.
I got the kind of anecdote.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So let's look at Chelsea. So what you need evidence to go, well, this is why this could happen. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you saw last night in previous games that make you think that this Chelsea team can suddenly get at least three? Because I'm like you. I don't think Real Madrid are going to Stamford Bridge and not scoring. Yeah. They'll get a goal.
The only thing that I would say is that obviously Chelsea weren't that good. And the hope, and obviously Real Madrid weren't either. So the only hope that I would have is that Real Madrid aren't that good in the next game either. And that possibly Chelsea can lift their performance massively in front of their own fans. Because ultimately you think, if Ben Chilwell didn't get sent off, are Chelsea possibly leaving the Bernabeu? And this is a totally out of form Chelsea who can't hit a barn door at the moment. 1-0 down on aggregate, and that could have been very possible.
I think Real Madrid are actually a little bit more suited in away games than they are at home. They look like a team that can counter brilliantly quick with Valverde, obviously Rodrigo, Vinicius Jr., yeah. Benzema. I think they're suited to that style of play.
And the other thing that I would say is I think tactically Chelsea should change now for the next leg, which is to play a 4-3-3, which I think you'll probably say plays even more into Real Madrid's hands, but I think they obviously need the goals. And ultimately, they still have a squad which is set up to play 4-3-3. The issue is the front man through the middle.
Yeah.
Who can you play off? Who, you know, you would need Kai Havertz to have one of the best games in his career. Because obviously you don't get that physicality from João Felix, although he looks to be the kind of, even though he's not scoring, he seems to be the kind of most active forward. And then Raheem Sterling's not going to play through the middle. I mean, it's
tough. Want to go to a midfield and push Mason Mount in front, like the diamond, and have Mason Mount around three up front.
Diamond, oh, I see. Okay.
I would want to do that way because I'm pretty sure away from home, obviously I haven't got the team sheet in front of me, but when Chelsea went 3-0 up in Madrid last time, Mason Mount was pivotal to the way they played that night. And even though he came on for a short period last night, he was the one that had chance that could have got them level. Mm. So I think Mount is quite an important player. I did a column with Tom a few weeks back and we were talking about very important players who could be sold from the Premier League to another Premier League club. And I went, there'll be a whole list of clubs after Mount.
Mm.
There will be.
Okay. Do you see it happening in the second leg?
No, I mean, again, I'm slightly more philosophical in terms of Chelsea's, not their chances in the tie, because obviously the 2-0 up away from home in a Champions League tie is absolutely peak Real Madrid. They're just going to win probably 3-0 all on the counter-attack, aren't they, with being picked off. But I would say from having watched lots of Chelsea, and we've talked lots about them, you know, you referenced the chance that Mount had. João Felix was in on goal, you know, real lack of pace there, which surprised me early on. Sterling's chance in the first half. You know, they created chances. Look, I'm trying to find positives where there aren't many. But listen, stranger things have happened, have they? Maybe.
Gregor?
Nope.
That'll do.
Can I just say as well, like, look at who they brought on in this game. They brought on Mount, Chalaba and Gallagher, three academy players after that £600 million spend, and Cucurella. I still can't get my head around what's happened at that club in the last 8 or 9 months. It's extraordinary. Like, the waste. I'm not saying it's all going to be a waste, but like, it's the extravagance and the way that the club's gone backwards in that time will go down as one of the most remarkable periods in a football club's history at the start of an ownership, like in Premier League history, I think.
Yeah,
it's the biggest vanity job you've ever seen.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you guys have seen the film Babylon, which came out recently, which is all about the kind of excesses of Hollywood in its heyday, then yeah, it pretty much feels like Chelsea and Todd Boehly have taken the Hollywood approach to a Premier League football club. And thankfully, they've got very deep pockets. That's all I can say. Otherwise, I think that football club might be in a bit of trouble. Anyway, let's talk about another club with deep pockets, Manchester City. They took a big step towards going through, as we mentioned already, into the semi-finals of the Champions League. Great performance, beating Bayern Munich at the Etihad Stadium, 3-0. Obviously, I'm not even going to say inevitably anymore, because there's no point checking. Erling Haaland on the score sheet. 45th goal of the season in all competitions, Tony. That makes him the highest scorer at a Premier League club in a single campaign since the Premier League began 30 years ago, going ahead of Mo Salah and Ruud van Nistelrooy. Best striker we've seen in England?
Well, he's only been here less than a year, so it's...
All right, best season.
Well, Clive Allen got 49 one year, didn't he? Done unbelievably well. And at least I don't have to get asked to do a column on Our City, a Better Team without him anymore. So I'm delighted by that because I found that, you know, that idea which many people had spoke about, which I just didn't get. He's an extraordinary player and is improving. And if he improves again, because he's still a very young man, which I expect him to, then what sort of player are we going to see in a year's time? Because he's at a football club that just create chances in many different ways. His athleticism is extraordinary. Agility, just watching him move his feet at the weekend to get a goal and then play a part in assists as well against Bayern Munich. I've already seen an improvement from him when he was at Borussia Dortmund. I already think he's a better player now than he was at Dortmund, and they invested all that money into him. because he is growing with this team.
I think he's a better player than we saw at the start of the season.
Yeah.
And I think he scored seven goals in the first three games or something. Yeah. And even now you can say, you know, there was a lot of, well, why didn't he get on the ball as much and why isn't he bringing other people into play as
doesn't
much?
Doesn't need to.
Early on.
Yeah.
But I'm saying he's doing that more and more. You can see those elements coming into his game and the goals aren't really fading away either. So I totally agree with you. We could see an incredible, I mean... Well, generational player soon.
Ask this question. Have we all put this question to ourselves? Who is capable of stopping him? What type of defender? Because of his being 6'5" and so quick and strong and direct and has an incredible desire, I don't know a defender in world football I could go and man mark him. Go and stand on him and just make sure he doesn't... Is there one?
The player that came to my head immediately was Ruben Dias, who obviously plays for the same team.
So
We're not going to see him, actually.
Ruben Dias is the one that came in terms of... And again, there was part of me that says, is he good enough? That's the only thing. I was like, Ruben Dias, well, he's got enough pace and he's got enough movement and mobility as a centre-back. He clearly brings the same type of aggression to his role as Erling Haaland brings at the other end of the pitch. But then I thought, in the penalty box, could he stay with him? And that's the only thing that comes into my mind. He probably is, in terms of the current best defenders, he's probably a level above, you know, being marked. You know, I just don't see anyone that can stop him. Gregor?
No, I mean, the thing that's actually consistently amazed me is his work rate and his mentality, actually, because as we've discussed, he's so often completely out of the game and his biggest task is pressing and hounding and harrying opposition defenders and goalkeepers in this game. I mean, his time when he closed down Jan Sommer, the Bayern keeper, and nearly scored from that, that's kind of epitomised his ridiculous work rate. And that's like, as I say, that's all he does for vast swathes of the game. He doesn't touch the ball, or if he does, it's like very fleetingly, or to score a goal. So those two things combined are the things that are like, have really wowed me in his time. Obviously, the goals are ridiculous, but I thought for a long period it was unsustainable that he was going to like be a player of his stature and his standing and his quality and be satisfied playing such a little part. But if they win the treble... and he scores 50-odd goals, then I think he'll probably be all right with it.
There was part of me watching this game, looking at Manchester City and the chances that they created, particularly the way that they managed to apply pressure to Sommer, who you mentioned already, the issues that he had with the ball at his feet and balls into the box. But then, of course, quite clearly, Upamecano, who made a couple of errors. And I think it was one of those where... You look at the game and everyone goes, oh, that's a Rick and that's a Rick. And they don't really look at what's going into creating those moments. Because actually, I think Manchester City put so many traps, covered so many passing angles, and then applied the pressure to the worst players on the ball to win it higher up the pitch. I actually thought, you know, for the football analysts out there, it was great to see a kind of... what's the way to describe it? The kind of proactive attacking defence, if you like, you know, and the ability to then have four or five bodies going into final third once you win the ball back. You know, it was beautiful to see. And the way that, you know, I think I tweeted about how fluid Manchester City were on the evening as well, because you looked at the formations, you went, okay, it's a 3-2-4-1, was it at times? Something like one, was it 3-2-3-1? I don't know what my numbers are, but yeah. And then you looked at it and it looked like a 3-2-3-2 at times. And then they dropped off and it was like a 4-4-2 at times. And it was just a 4-3-3. And I was watching it and I was like, this is sensational. This is just like a chameleon football team. And, you know, ultimately you watch that and go, you have to be so well drilled. The players have to be so tactically intelligent to realise when the ball's in a particular place, when a player's got the ball, this is the shape that we need to be in. And it was like, it was honestly, you know, aside from the game and you can say Bayern weren't great, that was something special to behold.
It was relentless. It certainly was. I mean, Tony, you talked about it before with fitness with Chelsea players, and you mentioned this off air earlier about Jack Grealish and looking as fit as you've ever seen him. That is what Pep Guardiola gets out of his players as well. As well as improving them like Erling Haaland, he gets them to be the absolute peak of their condition, doesn't he? The things you talked about, Hugh, we saw it against Leipzig and they're just taking it forward. I thought it was interesting, Ruben Dias talking before the game, saying that this is the moment in the season we get the taste for it, I think was his quote. And like so often in my life, I found myself thinking, oh God, Gregor Robertson's going to be right, because he's talked all season about the City juggernaut and it'll come. And I was, you know,
are you listening?
Yeah, I know.
No, but I'm being serious. The first time when I thought in big picture as well about the title race and about this team, I thought, oh God, he's right. Because they just look absolutely relentless. I would say just two things on two players, other players that I wanted to mention. Rodri, as well as scoring a brilliant goal, I think has been absolutely totemic for them this season. He's been absolutely superb. James Gearbrandt's Football Newsletter a few weeks ago focused on Willock at Newcastle, but within there, he had a statistic about midfielders in general using something called the Davis model, which is created by a data scientist to assess players' effectiveness compared to those who play in the same role. So you get a kind of ranking. And of players in the Premier League, Rodri had a score of 5.84, which was by far and away the best. Mm. So to give you some context, Kevin De Bruyne's was 4.36. And I just think he's been absolutely superb. Another player that I find kind of fascinating, and when you think about that kind of Pep bringing people on, is Nathan Ake. And I mean, that was one of the few transfers where City have signed a player and I've gone, really? But his evolution as a player, and to a point now where he's actually a really important player in the starting lineup. I don't know whether you guys agree, Gregor, as a defender. I don't know whether you agree.
Absolutely.
But his growth as a player as well, his composure on the ball, you know, it's incredible.
He's a better player than I thought he was. And that part of that may be to do with his improvement under Pep at City and playing in a better team. But I'd never seen it. I'd never seen the, you know, kind of clamour. You know, Chelsea tried to bring him back at one stage. I hadn't really seen it as an elite level kind of player, but this season he's been absolutely outstanding. And it is about the adaptability. The thing we're talking about here is so many players, use the word chameleon there, Hugh, so many players who are so adaptable. You know, you can put Rodri into that. He's dropped into the back four at times. Stones is, we're seeing a new side of Stones stepping into midfield. Akanji can play on the right almost like a fullback. Aki is a fullback or a centre-half. Bernardo Silva, we've not mentioned him yet. He's like...
Yeah.
You know, Pep saying that, I think Pep said after this game he's one of the most intelligent players he's ever coached, or the best player he's ever coached, because you're talking about those, you know, closing off passing lanes and stuff. He leads a lot of that too, and he's adaptable too. He can play in so many positions, and when they change shape, he moves from wide on the right to playing more narrow. De Bruyne goes up front to play to join Haaland when it's a 4-4-2. They really are like hitting form ominously. I think their aggregate scoreline I was reading is 34. to 4 in their last 9 games, 9 wins in a row.
Gregor.
And the last thing, sorry. They won this game with 44% of the ball too. That's the other thing. They're now content to almost drop into I think Hamza's piece online today said it was like almost like a back six. So when they're up, it's like 6-2-2-2. So that's another kind of, yeah, how often do you see City with 44% of the ball? No. I know they're playing against another kind of European giant, but even still, and to win 3-0 that way, it's like we're seeing new sides to them.
Just very quickly on Ake, just to bring it back there for a second, Tom, it's just for all of you to watch it. I went to the Arsenal game in the FA Cup where Saka didn't basically get a touch of the ball. Ake marked him out of the game. But actually, if you watch the Bayern game as well, what they tend to do is... they basically managed to get 6 players onto his side of the pitch. All he has to do is hold his winger up for a moment, and then suddenly he's got another centre back just behind him, and then you get 2 midfielders coming across, and the winger is forced backwards every single time. And it's just, I don't even know how they do it, but it's just like forcing you up a dead end street, and Ake's waiting for you at the end of it. Like, it's absolutely fantastic tactical work. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, I was going to say, Hugh, and again, something always amazes me about Pep Guardiola, and when he was at Bayern, he talked about Philipp Lahm, who played midfield and sometimes mainly right back for him. And he always spoke about his intelligence as a player. He said, Philipp Lahm is one of the most intelligent players I've ever worked with. And he loves intelligence in players. You know, what you've talked about there, Nathan Ake, Bernardo Silva, what Greg has just mentioned. You can go through his team. He loves intelligence in a player. It's not all about, of course, tactically, technically, but he wants them to be really savvy and really smart. It was interesting the week before that he commented on Kyle Walker about not being able to do the John Stones role because, you know, he had John's intelligence. So to him... intelligence as a footballer is really important if you're going to achieve the ultimate goals.
Yeah,
you have to throw in Grealish there too.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Grealish was the ultimate maverick, and now he's completely on the ball as what he has to do out of possession, and like to the point where he's even, you know, pressing, winning the ball back, and creating goals from those kind of situations. He's really got on board with what he has to do out of position as to be in this team, basically. And that's he's another player who's kind of, we're seeing a new side as well.
What are the other managers in Europe thinking and Arteta thinking when they're watching this Man City now? They're thinking, that's not the same team as the start of the season.
They're thinking what I was thinking. Gregor bloody Robertson's right. They're coming. The juggernaut's coming.
There's still a part of me though that was watching them in the Champions League this week and thinks it might be so important for that group of players, a lot of them as well, who've been there and kind of failed in this competition. And I wonder, if they're going to play Real Madrid in the semi-final, whether the focus goes on that mentally, whether rotation comes in ahead of those games. And we see Man City drop points in another match. Look, I still don't think they're going to win every game between here and the end of the season. But certainly watching them against Bayern, you think they've got a great chance, probably a better chance than ever, to win the Champions League, because the other English sides nowhere near good enough apart from City, obviously. You've got, several Italian teams left. You've got Portuguese team left. The greats of Europe, Bayern Munich, clearly aren't at it. Paris Saint-Germain already gone, they weren't at it, and you kind of think, is this Man City's year? And how content would they be as a football club in winning the Champions League, even if it means they don't win an FA Cup, even if they don't win the Premier League? So I still kind of think...
How did Brentford beat them at the Etihad?
I think they're all thinking about the World Cup, honestly. That was the last game before the World Cup, right? And I think City, who had more players, went to the World Cup than any other club side in the world. I think a lot of their players were kind of thinking, I've got to get the plane tomorrow, and that was maybe a bit of a distraction. Obviously,
also, they hit Ivan Toney.
I was about to say, and Ivan Toney was kind of galvanised by being left out of the England squad, yeah.
We should quickly say that, like, Bayern did have, although this wasn't peak Bayern, it was nip and tuck until Rodri's goal, and kind of moments beforehand, Musiala had a great chance. It was brilliantly blocked by Ruben Dias, and then it was Musiala who was turned by Rodri at the other end for Man City to take the lead. So, and even then, Sané went through in the second half, had a good chance, it was saved. They still created openings. They will create openings.
But they won't beat City by three.
Coming back, no.
No. So I don't have to ask, is this tie over? I think it's done. And a couple of things to keep an eye on, which is basically, will Erling Haaland get any better? And City, to just be kind of metronomic until the end of the season, they are definitely getting better. And during the fallow period of the season, there was a thought that, is he kind of saving his players' legs a little bit, his best players' legs? Because remember, the bench was probably better than the starting 11 for a good couple of months there. And that was the point where people thought, City have absolutely no chance, including me. And I kind of give them more of a chance now, but I still think Arsenal win the Premier League since they've been knocked out of Europa. They're going to be playing one game a week. They're not in the FA Cup. I still think they've got more than enough in their legs to win virtually every game, if not every game, between here and the end of the season. So I still think it's going to be a big task for Manchester City.
It's more interesting to see who'd win out of Mane and Sane.
I mean, yeah, I kind of...
Whatever happened there?
I watched that and thought, oh, misfits boxing, yeah. I mean, if you missed the story, Sadio Mane, former Liverpool forward, clobbered Leroy Sané, the former Manchester City winger, punched him in the face, apparently. I'm just reading on our screens above us that he is expected to apologise at Bayern Munich training a little bit later on. But it happens, Tony, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Ever punched anyone?
Not in football, no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of reading all about Bayern, and that is another thing, isn't it? The City are so in sync at the minute as a club in general, whereas Bayern changed the manager. Yes, they've got Thomas Tuchel in. But you should be able to read as well later on the Times, probably now while you're listening to this. Constantine Eckner, who's our guy, man in Germany, has written all about what's going on at Bayern and whether they can turn it around. Because obviously for them, a club of that stature, we talk about Real Madrid losing a Champions League quarterfinal first leg 3-0. Never mind a player dust-up. That's pretty disastrous. So for them, that's a pretty big point in their season.
I was just watching the camera because kind of where the dugouts are, it kind of goes in and out of shot depending on where the ball is on the pitch. And every time it went to the near side and Thomas Tuchel basically came back into vision, it was just like arms flailing around furiously. I mean, he was just furious for the entire match. And I did read a little bit this morning about kind of the size of the task that he's got at Bayern Munich, but ultimately there was a part of me that almost reflecting on this defeat, and if it continues for Bayern Munich, that they aren't going to challenge really strongly for the Champions League. And I know they won it not too long ago, as football changes, as the European Super League comes back to the table in another form, obviously being one of the big clubs that was completely against it. And I know they've got a different ownership model that means fans are far more involved. But you kind of sit there and think, how's the Bundesliga? How is a club like Bayern Munich going to get its competitive advantage back against the likes of Manchester City? Because it's not going to be in terms of finances. You kind of think if they're not going to do something that radically gets them lots more money back into the club, then where are Bayern Munich going to be? Because I think one of the strange things is, yes, we've had an Italian resurgence, but we kind of need the big five nations to have some very strong teams for European football to be worth it. Otherwise, it basically becomes...
Don't say it. I thought you were going to say Super League. Don't say it.
No, it will basically become the Premier League with some European clubs attached, which is not what we want. One of the best things about this season has been Benfica, has been Napoli. You know, you want European football to be about Europe and to have strong contenders from across the continent. Bayern Munich have been such a constant in that regard in terms of Germany's representation that for me, I kind of wasn't expecting this. And I'm kind of watching their squad and watching what's happening to Tuchel and thinking, how's he going to improve this team? And I don't see it. You know, they're not going to compete with the biggest clubs for the best signings at this point in time. You know, they might get a Sadio Mane who leaves a club, you know, on a free transfer or for a minimal fee if he's got a year left on his deal. But are they going to go out and get the best players in world football? Like, for Bayern Munich to not be in the conversation, for me, is kind of strange, you know. And anyway, that's where they are right now. Reid Constantine Ekner, who I'm sure knows a lot more about it than me. That's the Champions League wrapped up. We got more to talk about next. We'll be talking about Leicester City and Dean Smith. We'll talk about Jude Bellingham's future and reflect on that huge game in the National League. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed.
Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Dean Smith has been named as Leicester City boss until the end of the season. He obviously left Norwich earlier this season. He had his previous spells at Aston Villa and Brentford as a manager. Leicester in massive trouble after their defeat by Bournemouth at home. 2 points from safety with 8 games left. Strangely, I guess a lot has been made about the backroom staff that Dean Smith brings with him. Craig Shakespeare is his assistant manager. He was part of Claudio Ranieri's backroom staff when Leicester won the league in 2016. He then replaced the Italian as their manager. But also in the coaching lineup, John Terry, the former England captain, who was with Dean Smith at Aston Villa, and the club's current first team coaches, Adam Sadler and Mike Stowell. The first game in charge for Leicester is away at the Premier League champions Manchester City on Saturday. So it pretty much couldn't be harder in terms of his first match in charge. But really, I've got to ask you guys whether you think this is a good decision and how much it improves Leicester's chances of staying up. Tom Clark.
It's so difficult to answer simply yes or no. It's a good decision. It is a good decision in the sense that they looked like they were free-falling towards relegation. And so bringing someone in like Dean Smith, who has at least got experience, you know, at the level of a club like Leicester, he's managed other big clubs before, he's managed in relegation scraps before. Yes, that's a good decision. But it's a good decision in the wider context of some more very bad and mad decisions, I think, at Leicester. You know, I've been speaking to Charlotte Dunker, who's our Midlands correspondent, and the kind of rhythms of these managerial changes, and you're speaking to her 1 minute and then, you know, some of our other reporters suggesting that they, you know, they want Rafa Benitez to come in, but he doesn't want to move to Leicester. And it's this complete lack of plan. So you go through this entire process of sacking a manager like Brendan Rodgers, where you've maybe waited too long to sack him, then go through a process of, is it Jesse Marsh? Is it Rafa Benitez? Is it others? And then you end up with Dean Smith as interim, and then you're going, well, that's a good call. Good call, solid pair of hands, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a good call in the context of the chaos that came before it. So to answer your question, yes, it's a good decision, it's a good move, but it's only a good move because of all the nonsense that came before it. And I mean, nothing against Dean Smith, but I think they're in real trouble because I don't think this is a managerial appointment that kind of stops a bit of the rot that's kind of set in and a bit of, it feels like free fall. And as you say, got Manchester City, so big troubles, I think, ahead.
Yeah, I think it's been going on for a long time, the downfall of Leicester. Last summer was a weird one. Kasper Schmeichel leaving the club, and he was served 11 years there, and he just went without any really recognition from the club, and that was strange. And then seeing Vardy be everything that Vardy's not. He's basically been a bit part player, scored one Premier League goal, a real huge character in the team. Nothing's happened. And okay, you could argue that, well, he's been an outside and he hasn't been performing and scoring goals. Then you go, well, then there's all Brighton moved on, another big character at the football club. They've had transfers. The goalkeeper, Danny Ward, who took Schmeichel's place, has ended up losing his place. It feels like everything Leicester have done this year, and that's without all the injuries, because they have had a wholesale changes in many different positions. I just found, there are some great things have happened. Harvey Barnes has got a lot of goals this year. Madison's played really well at times, done really well. And yet this team has been in freefall that, I can only assume that the atmosphere is terrible at Leicester. I can only assume that, because a lot of it doesn't add up how this team has got himself second from bottom in the Premier League.
Do you think Dean Smith can get something out of them? Is it just going to be a new voice, a new face to give you some new ideas that might see them jump up the league?
Well, I think Craig Shakespeare will play a big part, because he obviously will know a lot of these players, and he's been working at Leicester before, and he'll be the eyes for Dean Smith. John Terry's interesting, because I did laugh. I said to somebody I was working on radio with, why didn't you do a poll when Lampard got the job? I said, ask Chelsea fans, who would they prefer, Terry or Lampard, to be given that interim job? And John Terry come out quite clearly. This is before Lampard, well, he'd been announced, but he hadn't had a game. John Terry's a really interesting one, because he's quite silent in many ways. It doesn't feel like he's the captain leader when he's at a football club. And I'm only going on, I've met John on two or three occasions and talked to him, but he's quite a distant guy. He's quite very discreet. You wouldn't think that John's the type of guy he is when you meet him. And yet he was the leader, the captain of Chelsea for all these years. And you think he walks into that dressing room, he's going to lay some laws down. But from what I hear, he's not like that. He's far more standoffish and watches and then, gives his side of how he feels what the team is doing. So it's a really weird dynamic what Leicester have put together. Good luck to them, because as much as Gregor had talked about Chelsea in a real mess, I don't think anybody's been in a bigger mess in the Premier League than Leicester this year.
I kind of agree with Tony. I think that a big part of these changes is about changing the atmosphere. And Dean Smith is kind of well regarded. I think he's a good guy. I know people have played for him and enjoyed it, and think he's, as I say, he's a good guy and very competent as well. So that's a good start point when the atmosphere's bad. And I think, as referenced, Shakespeare's kind of knowledge of the club and being there before will be important. It's still impossible to call. Like, we've been saying it for weeks. And I think we just look at the state of the Premier League right now. It's remarkable. Southampton, I've got a manager till the end of the season. Leicester, I've got an interim manager to the end of the season. Leeds, I've got an interim manager to the end of the season. Crystal Palace, I've got an interim manager to the end of the season. Chelsea, I've got an interim manager to the end of the season. I think Gary O'Neill got a longer term contract, didn't he, at Bournemouth?
Yes, he did, yeah.
And so did Deitch. But like, how many clubs just panicked and looked around, had no succession plan? Actually, the one club I would give credit to, bizarrely, in this, and you'll think I'm mad, is Southampton, because they had a plan. It didn't work, but they had a plan. They put a lot of thought into appointing Nathan Jones. Clearly, it was a disaster, but at least they had some thought process about it. Everyone else has been flapping around in the dark looking for someone who is faintly qualified to manage a Premier League club, to keep them in the league. It's absolutely ludicrous. Like, I'm sure, I know running a football club is difficult, and clearly this is a problem that's afflicted a lot of clubs this season, particularly because it's been so concertinaed in the bottom half of the league, and that's made more clubs feel like they're Premier League status is in peril, but there's been some really bad stewardship of Premier League football clubs this year.
It is fascinating, isn't it, how we've now got to, you know, we've always had these managers for a long time in the Premier League, the kind of Mark Hugheses, the Sam Allardyces, the firefighters, but they'd always get 3.5 year deals when they'd come in, wouldn't they? And then they'd get sacked next season. It'd be a great payoff. But it's amazing how these managers are now, you know, the negotiation is it's 6 months, it's 3 months, it's to the end of the season, it's interim. And we've now got this whole different breed. And as you say, Gregor, it does feel that it's almost part of a lack of a plan. But the idea is that it is part of a plan thinking forward, so i.e. we don't need to give them to beyond the end of the season. I just wanted to shout out as well, Aston Villa, if you're talking about plans and, you know, making changes, they made a change early with Steven Gerrard and massively reaping the rewards, as Henry Winter wrote this week, talking about Unai Emery up into 7th, is it now?
Yeah.
You know, and think maybe at the start of the season you'd have been thinking they might have been in position of Leicester, you know, a big club with badly managed who've gone the wrong way, but they made good decisions, acted quickly, and then they get the rewards. Whereas that's why I come back to Leicester. You think about that, there's no plan, and I don't really understand what the plan was with sacking Rodgers in the first place.
Southampton went after Jesse Marsh. He demanded a longer contract. They didn't get the deal through. And then he goes to Leicester, and then that deal fell apart. And what Tom was saying there is that clubs are going, we're not going to give these guys longer deals. They come in under our terms, because every club at any level gets 100 applicants at least for a job. They do. You know, if you're Coventry City tomorrow, you'd get a whole host of names putting their name to it, because people want to be involved in football. But Jesse Marsh has took two jobs where he's basically been offered it, but he's refused it because of the length of the contract.
The thing is that it's also kind of jarring to me this season is that the people we're talking about here are, I think, I would personally say, are not qualified for the jobs. Like, is would Javi Gracia be offered Leeds' job at any other juncture in the season? Would Dean Smith, who was just sacked by Norwich in the Championship, would Ruben Telles? I know he's like a guy who came from the back room.
Telles, that's how bad it is. You don't even know his name.
Would Frank Lampard, God damn it. Like, it's mental. That's what I'm saying. They're struggling to find people who are qualified to be Premier League managers at this stage of the season. There's been, when they've looked overseas, when people have looked at Arne Slot, I think his name is in the Dutch league, they don't want to come because they're in a good position, and they know that at the end of the season they'll wait and see who stays up, and they'll probably have, there's a group of managers who'll probably be in the running for several Premier League jobs. But to come now is like a massive shot in the dark. Are you going to keep them up? And then you're a Championship manager.
I totally agree with you, Gregor. And I'd have to say, I was amazed to see Dean Smith. Now, I'm not amazed in terms of there's no one else. I heard, you know, some Leicester fans saying, you know, I think it's a terrible decision. Others saying, you know, it's a really positive decision. I don't dislike Dean Smith. I just don't think he's a Premier League manager. And I think it's a huge risk. Now, obviously, if there was no one else to take the job, then fair enough. You know, he's at a certain level. It's a pretty good level in terms of, for me, top half, maybe even top six Championship manager. But, you know, based on what we saw in his last job, even at Villa, by the way, who, you know, if the goal line technology was working against Sheffield United, you know, Villa would have got relegated straight away. And they wouldn't be seventh in the Premier League right now. They'd probably be, you know, seventh in the Championship. You know, so for me, you know, when Dean Smith returns in a permanent job, it will be in the Championship. He gets a great opportunity here to show that he's still got something at this level, but it's a huge risk for me. It's a huge risk.
By the way, we also missed Christian Stellini.
Yeah, Stellini from Spurs, yeah. I think Tottenham almost wrote their season off with that appointment.
Six.
Yeah, yeah, it's a lot. In a word, just, you know, got to make a prediction from this point in time. Do you think Leicester are staying up?
No.
Wow. Gregor?
That's hard.
Oh, here he comes. He said one word, Gregor. He said one word.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to say yes, not based on Dean Smith, but just based on firepower.
They've got the fixtures as well. I was looking like after this, I was looking and thinking just before I made that prediction, I thought, sod it, I'm going to go with it. And plus Tony said no, so it doesn't look bad if I copy him. But, you know, they've got Wolves at home, Leeds away, Everton at home, Fulham away, the four games after this weekend. So, you know, if he gets them in some sort of shape, then those fixtures give them a chance.
Right, not long to go on the podcast, 5 or so minutes. So let's quickly talk about another couple of stories that we've had for you this week. A couple of exclusives in the Times when it comes to Jude Bellingham's future. Liverpool are looking at alternative targets. They've decided the scale of their summer rebuild precludes a move for the England midfielder. And Real Madrid making Jude Bellingham their top transfer target this summer. After a meeting between senior figures at the club and representatives acting for the England midfielder, Manchester City apparently now the main rivals for Bellingham's signature to the Spanish club. So some great, you know, great horizons for Jude Bellingham. Could be playing at a massive club, Real Madrid, that is, next summer. £130 million, the price tag. Tony, what do you think should happen with Jude Bellingham's career next?
It was interesting chatting earlier about intelligence of players and Jude Bellingham. If you listen to him talk and what he did going as a kid to Dortmund and taking his family with him and fitting in brilliantly, not with any hip cups at all, he's clearly an intelligent man, young man, 19 years old. If I was him and I was thinking who's going to improve me, I'd probably go at City because of what we talked about earlier with City players and how working under Pep just takes you to a new level. I mean, he's an extraordinary talent anyway. It's very hard because looking beyond Real Madrid is nearly impossible 9 times out of 10. And you could probably put Barcelona in that bracket, even though they probably won't be in this market. I think he could do both. He could end up at both in some way because he's young enough, you know.
Who at 19? Where would you go first?
Well, I'd definitely go to Guardiola first,
yeah?
I think. Yeah, because I think, I mean, look, Real Madrid are a fantastic football club, but a lot of ageing players that I do think that City have the capability to do what Real Madrid have done, conquer Europe on a regular basis. I do think they have that.
It'd be a hell of a double transfer, won't it, when Bellingham and Haaland go from City to Real Madrid in about 5 years' time. They've won it all at City and then they move on. I mean, it'll be astronomical. The first £1 billion double transfer is a terrifying thought. But I mean, it is interesting, Hugh, and I wanted to just briefly come back to Paul Joyce's original exclusive about Liverpool. We've talked so much, particularly of late, about PR in football these days, and I do think it's a very savvy move from Liverpool to kind of step back in a quite public way, you know, with this story and kind of go, no, not for us. Because it's smart in a broader sense, you know. I'd be interested to know what Tony thinks as a fan, whether, you know, obviously he's sad about the idea of not getting Bellingham, but the idea of getting other players instead and making more sensible decisions. But also the other thing is, you as a Manchester United fan, you've suffered this in many summer transfer windows. The whole going after a player and being beaten to them, you know, because ultimately, if they'd have been in this race as a three-horse race with City and Real Madrid, they would have been beaten. And I don't care how persuasive Jordan Henderson is,
that,
you know, they would have been. So I think it's very smart from Liverpool on two levels, this kind of move at this stage in the season, preempting it, stepping back and saying, top player, not for us.
I do think it was smart. I do think it also manages the fan base in terms of the disappointment that you
alluded
to.
Exactly.
But also in terms of the spending, because I think that's an interesting thing. Even if you miss out on Bellingham, right, there's going to be people saying, well, we had the money for Bellingham, so why don't we go and spend £100 million on another player? You know, let's get this one next. You know, I think in terms of managing the expectations of the fans when it comes to how much money Liverpool can spend on this rebuild, I think that's really important because ultimately, I don't want to be harsh on the Liverpool fans. I remember being called harsh on the Everton fans when I said, look, you've run out of money. And it's going to be a hard few years for you. And that's just the reality of the situation. Obviously, Liverpool haven't run out of money. But, you know, the reality will hit for some fans. Some already know it, that they can't spend at that very high level that other clubs do. And they're going to have to get back to what has made them so successful, which is finding those deals, finding those diamonds, doing things a little bit differently, maybe another academy player, you know. And for me, the squad has been set up really well in terms of those young players. So it might just be about time, not even money, to get Liverpool back to where they have been under Jurgen Klopp at the very high point, because there are some excellent players that they've signed. We all know the young players that they've got there and some of the exciting forward players. It's now just, can we focus in on maybe another centre-back, maybe a couple of full-backs to supplement what we've already got? And then, of course, the big midfield rebuild, who goes out of the club and who comes in. But, you know, is it going to be a £300 million summer for Liverpool? No, it's not. You know, and ultimately that's, I think, something that all the fans are going to have to just take on the chin.
As good as Bellingham is, I don't think he's the absolute needed player at this moment. I think they have to get ball winners back into their midfield. because they lack that. That we talked about the pressure on back fours that has come for having a midfield that weren't as competitive as what they've had before. I think that's really important for Liverpool, because Liverpool play a style where you have to win the ball back.
Well, you talk about winning the ball back. I think the interesting thing about the Jude Bellingham conversation and the rumours around what club he's going to go to is the knock-on effect on what it might have for another player in Declan Rice, because surely there's another kind of market just slightly below that, maybe like 40 million less, where there's going to be more teams in there who might want him more, who might need him more. You talk about Liverpool, maybe Manchester United, Arsenal as well, we believe, are in the race for Declan Rice. That, to me, is a far more interesting battle as to where he goes.
Also, and I think this is a Liverpool way of thinking, and it should be the way, because Fergie was very much like this as well, is don't ever go for a player that thinks he's doing you a favour to come to you. You know, because I think you have to want a player desperate to say, I want to play for this manager, this football club. And if you know you're going to get that with your club, that's the one you go after.
Gregor, what do you think of this whole situation?
I think that Liverpool are kind of following what we expect of them. They're not a club that gets drawn into bidding wars or huge battles and tussles and tugs of war. That's what Manchester United have done. it's not really Liverpool's forte. And I think probably, like, from a logical standpoint, you know, if they don't make the Champions League, they're going to be short another 40-odd million pounds. The scale of the overhaul that they need would ultimately make it a logical decision to not put all your eggs in one basket. If I was Bellingham, like, I agree with Tony, it's about going to City and working with Pep Guardiola. It's the most. It's the team that's the kind of the most tranquil. That's the right word. It's like the most sort of
stable
and steady. And and yeah, you know, its future is going to be competing always. But that also makes it, as a fan and a neutral, a little bit unpalatable. You know, it kind of almost a change of tack from City. They're spending 100 million on Jack Grealish. They're throwing, I know it's a nominal fee and relatively speaking for Haaland, but throwing enormous wages at Haaland, and it'd be, you know, a huge fee for Bellingham as well. It does start to get a little bit unpalatable. But I think from Bellingham's point of view, and if you're an England fan, which you'll know I'm not, I would say work with Guardiola as well. We've just waxed lyrical about what he's done to so many players, and you'd hate to, well, you'd love to think what you could possibly do with Bellingham too.
I just think Bellingham is so ambitious that you're looking at Real Madrid setting themselves up with the midfield of the future to replace Casemiro's already gone, but then Kroos and Modric coming towards the end. You've got Camavinga there already, you've got Tchouaméni, you've got Valverde, you add a Bellingham to that, they might sit there for a decade winning trophy after trophy after trophy. Why wouldn't you want to be an integral part of the future of Real Madrid? It's such a difficult thing to say no to.
I think you're right, but we talked about savvy and intelligence. You know, these guys, and I've talked about PR. I was only half joking about the Haaland-Bellingham double transfer to Real Madrid. Like, you know, I don't think Erling Haaland is going to be at Manchester City for the rest of his career. I think he sees it as like conquering European football, world football. I want to play in every league. I want to win everything at every club. In a similar way to Guardiola as a coach, he wants to coach every league, every top club, and win everything he possibly can. And I wouldn't be surprised if Bellingham's thinking the same thing and map it out like that. I'll go 5 years, 6 years at City, try and win the lot, and then I'll get my move to La Liga. Yeah. And maybe onwards and finish with a couple of years in Italy. Yeah, lovely job.
I also think Bellingham's enjoyed leaving England. And I think there is a detachment from not playing for one of the big English clubs in terms of how the fans treat you, but also in terms of the pressure from the media. Just being out of the way a little bit. I think he's thrived in that regard. I know he was playing for Birmingham City, so, you know, in terms of the big headlines, he was already, you know, a young kid who wasn't exactly in the middle of them. But I think yes, that would ramp up massively in going to Real Madrid. I'm not naive enough to think that there wouldn't be huge pressure on him there, but I think in terms of his position in this country, in terms of the national team, you know, being Real Madrid midfielder and coming into the England camp might suit Jude Bellingham. Anyway, big decision for him to make. Lovely decision for him to make in many ways. Just very quickly before we go, Gregor, we know you're out in Ghent at the moment. Not the most scenic place you've been this week, though, because you went to Wrexham's game against Notts County in the National League, which I think a lot of people were keeping an eye over on Easter Monday. Ben Foster, out of retirement, back in the Wrexham team for the last couple of weeks, and he had an integral moment in the game where he ensured Wrexham's victory by saving an injury time penalty, but also I think means that Wrexham are in the firmly driver's seat in terms of winning the National League and getting promoted into League Two as well. But it was, I had a message from a mate who, by the way, had just got back from, like, he'd just come off a plane from Brazil or something. He'd been away with his partner and he'd sat down and he watched the Wrexham Notts County game, and yeah, he was like, this is the best game I've watched all season.
Yeah, I had the same messages. I was working and I was slightly dismayed by the whole thing. I was desperate for Notts County to equalise because I'm just a bit of a cynic about the whole documentary element of Wrexham's success. But I had the same thing. Mates who'd never watched the National League, couldn't get them to a Lincoln game if I'd begged them. And they're watching Wrexham Notts County going, this is the best game I've ever seen.
Someone told me that, like, by a multiple of, well, a large multiple, the number of people who clicked on the final score of Wrexham Notts County and was, like, vastly superior to Liverpool Arsenal.
Like, really?
We cannot like
overstate. See, and you say we don't send you to the big games, mate. What are you on?
I know, yeah. We cannot overstate the impact like the documentary has had and like celebrity status has had on Wrexham, clearly, but also on the National League. I mean, I know it's a massive cliche that everyone trotted out in the reports, but like, you couldn't have scripted it. They couldn't have the two teams have been tied on 100 points and like a top of the table clash are 25 points ahead of the nearest rivals and basically a game to decide who's most likely to be promoted. And it was just bonkers. The second half was, Notts County were like such a clash of styles as well. You know, Notts County were like possession dominant, patient, building play from the back. Their manager Luke Williams looked every inch the Pep Guardiola disciple with his bald head and his puffer jacket and his white trainers on the touchline. And Wrexham were up and at them, like a bit more kind of traditional English blood and thunder football with a pacey front man and Paul Mullen up front and a big man, Ollie Palmer, trying to spring the offside trap. And County had by far the best of the play in the first half, but in the second half, Wrexham came out and they absolutely blitzed them. They like threw everything at them, and then County came back, and then Wrexham took the lead again. And you think they're home and dry, and then the penalty at the end—it was just bonkers. It was like the stadium was in a frenzy, and at Wrexham's stadium, the press box is not a press box; it's a row of seats directly in front of the fans' rows of seats. So I was getting some spittle and and cries of howls of anguish in my ear and all over my laptop, and then he saved it, and it was just bonkers. Amazing game. And I know there are many cynics in that room there, and I'm often a cynic when I'm there with you, but Ben Foster was clearly like enthralled by what had happened. And we know that he's got this YouTube channel and podcast, and there's part of this is clearly part of the lure of returning to football was going to be what that does to his content, a large part. Yes, I'm sure that's true. But when he was saying afterwards, this is one of two moments that I would like bottle in my career. This is again, like, I've not played in many games like that. He believed him. Like, it was extraordinary. And, you know, he was talking about, because he started there when he was 18, he was on loan from Stoke, and he got his move to Manchester United on the back of playing in the LDV Vans Trophy Final. He's saying that, like, you know, two decades on, his family that were coming to watch him at the start of his career are now coming to watch him at the end of his career, kind of helping Wrexham back into the Football League. So, yes.
He's bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. Get him on the second season. He's bought it.
Listen, you can be cynical about it all. You can be cynical about why they bought the club, Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. But at the same time, whilst acknowledging the fact that they are loving the ride, they are enjoying it. And I've said it on the podcast before, there are many worse reasons for people to either buy a football club or come out of retirement. And we saw how much they enjoyed it, and everyone else did too.
All I hope for is that we get fewer interviews with club owners. It's just make it about the players, make it about the fans.
Has Greg not told you about his selfie with Ryan Reynolds?
You know, make it about the groundsman or the person who's on reception or sells teas or I don't know, whatever it might be, sells programs. Make it about those people. That's all I'm going
to
say.
Coming to ITV next season, Hugh Wozencroft interviews Ryan Reynolds on the opening show of the season, and guaranteed.
Absolutely. But all I'm going to say is, you know, make it about those people. There's so many broadcasters and journalists, you know, if we haven't heard enough from Ryan Reynolds already, please, all right, if they get promoted, if they win the league, make it about the players. All right, that's all I'm going to say. That's all I'm going to say, all right? To end the podcast on a positive note anyway, Tony Cascarino, been a pleasure to be with you. Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson, enjoy Ghent. I guess we might reflect on whatever happens in the Europa League quarterfinals a little bit later on as well.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Well, Manchester United in action against Sevilla. But, of course, we've got a big Premier League weekend ahead of us. We'll be with you with the game on Monday, so make sure you download the Times app. You can pick up a newspaper as well. You can subscribe online at thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you then. Take care.